Right now, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't quite know how I'm going to do it. Tell me what I'm going to do, Lee. I'm going to take questions now, so. Yes?
How much is the manager based on Bill Tubishley?
It's based more on a guy who used to be a production manager called John Wolfe. John Wolfe was the guy who said to me once, I haven't got any cash. So I said, well, you go to the bank. And he said, no, you don't understand. I haven't got any of your cash.
Hey, the new CD you brought out, in America you brought out a dialogue, one with no dialogue, censored dialogue, and the music CD.
Who brought that out?
Well, no, for promotional purposes.
Yeah.
Will it ever be released for the public?
No, I don't think so.
No, what about releasing it on, like, limited edition singles?
The point there is obviously that the music should exist without the dialogue. My feeling is that if it was worthy of existing without the music, that's how I would have put it out. When I actually assembled the songs, and I think you can see, when I play them in this kind of frame tonight, I think you can actually, today, you can actually see that they're very simple songs. None of them are what I would call great songs, particularly. They're very important songs to me, and they're quite subtle, but they're kind of... where the energy lies is in the lyric, and I actually just felt that they didn't work as songs in quite the way that I'd hoped. They didn't have the force, and I think that the play adds something that was really missing. It adds a contextual element that's really vital for the songs to work, so that you know where they're coming from, and you know that it's not anger, you know that it's not bitterness, it's not cynicism, it's not... It's not real, the place where the song is coming from. It's actually a place that I created where I invested in writing, and that is established as well.
Is there anything that sort of triggered this off, triggered off the writing?
I think I've said in a couple of interviews that when I first started to write the songs, I was interested in writing about honesty in relationships. And that was a theme that I had, and then later on I started to look at what the kind of societal equivalent of that was, and decided that was probably about whether or not, when we read facts in the newspapers, whether or not it's possible from facts in the newspapers to get the truth. It's not to say that the newspapers print lies, I know they do, but not always. But rather that history seems to me to be made up of people, of historians deciding what has happened, which isn't always the truth, but it becomes the truth, and at least you know what happened in history because some historian told you. Today what will happen, or in the future what will happen, is people will go and wade through databases full of facts about what apparently happened, and they'll have to decide for themselves. That might appear to be a better situation, but I'm not quite sure. And it was just really to address that in the play. One of the things that Ray rattles on a lot about is whether or not in the technological future, the march of technology, whether or not we'll be closer to the truth or further away from it. I don't know.
How much of Ray is there in you, Pete?
Hey,
sir. How much of Ray is there in you?
A bit, obviously. A lot of the things that he says are things that I've plucked out of essays or brainstorms or brain farts, whatever you want to call them, some of which go back 25 years. So in order to give him a sense, the things that Spinner says on the tape, the young boy, are things that I wrote for a script that I did with The Who immediately after Tommy, a thing called Lifehouse, which was meant to follow up Tommy, and didn't.
Can you explain the problem with that Lifehouse stuff? What is the relationship with that?
What, with this story?
Yeah.
It knits in because it's a dream, a vision that actually was... authentic. I wanted Ray to have a big dream. You know, I wanted him to be somebody who looked back at those kind of Glastonbury years and felt that there was something great there that had been lost. I think a lot of people do feel that. A lot of people of my age. I'm not sure that I agree entirely. I think that what happened in the 70s was that the dream of the 60s got blown apart somehow by virtue of the pursuit of the dream itself. In other words, that everybody was scrabbling so much at ideas, so much at presentation, so much at grandiosity, that they lost the original idea, which was that a great pop song tells a story in itself, reflects something in itself. And in the fuff and kerfuffle that went on in the late 70s, pre-punk, just pre-punk, it was definitely lost. And I couldn't really work out what to give Ray as an authentic dream, so I thought, well, fuck it, I'll give him my authentic dream, which was The Lifehouse, which immediately after Tommy, I wrote this film script for Universal called Lifehouse, and it was a piece about virtual reality, what we now know as virtual reality. And I'm not the first person to have dreamed up virtual reality in a science fiction format. I think that was Arthur C. Clarke. He wrote a book about something very much like virtual reality in 1942, which I read that fact in Mondo 2000. But it was a kind of obsessive period of mine, and I think in a way I was going through a period of white genius. You know, I was actually so full of different ideas and getting on to electronic music the one thing that you saw from that period was the records that the Who made at the time. The record that the Who made at the time, which was Who's Next, which produced probably the most famous and radio-worthy music that the Who has ever produced, Iron Blue Eyes. Those tracks were, and particularly Won't Get Forward Again and Barbara O'Reilly, were a product of an electronic music obsession that I had at the time. So I gave Ray that dream, because what happened to that project was that it was lost. It was too ambitious, and it was lost. So I gave him that. I gave him my dream. So in a sense, there is a part of that. My dream at the time, I'm not really interested in it now. Or if I am interested in it now, I would be interested in doing it in a slightly different way.
How many songs are taken from Lifehouse, as opposed to the newer songs?
About
4 or 5.
Can you explain the problem that Lifehouse got to play? What is the relationship with that?
What, with this story?
Yeah.
It knits in because it's a dream, a vision that actually was authentic. I wanted Ray to have a big dream. You know, I wanted him to be somebody who looked back at those kind of Glastonbury years and felt that there was something great there that had been lost. I think a lot of people do feel that. A lot of people of my age. I'm not sure that I agree entirely. I think that what happened in the 70s was that the dream of the 60s got blown apart somehow by virtue of the pursuit of the dream itself. In other words, that everybody was scrabbling so much at ideas, so much at presentation, so much at grandiosity, that they lost the original idea, which was that a great pop song tells a story in itself, reflects something in itself. And in the fuff and kerfuffle that went on in the late 70s, pre-punk, just pre-punk, it was definitely lost. And I couldn't really work out what to give Ray as an authentic dream, so I thought, well, fuck it, I'll give him my authentic dream, which was The Lifehouse, which immediately after Tommy, I wrote this film script for Universal called Lifehouse, and it was a piece about virtual reality, what we now know as virtual reality. And I'm not the first person to have dreamed up virtual reality in a science fiction format. I think that was Arthur C. Clarke. He wrote a book about something very much like virtual reality in 1942, which I read that fact in Mondo 2000. But it was a kind of obsessive period of mine, and I think in a way I was going through a period of white genius. You know, I was actually so full of different ideas and getting on to electronic music the one thing that you saw from that period was the records that the Who made at the time, which was Who's Next, which produced probably the most famous and radio-worthy music that the Who has ever produced. You know, Won't Get Forward Again, Barbara O'Reilly, Behind Blue Eyes, those tracks were, and particularly Won't Get Forward Again and Barbara O'Reilly were a product of an electronic music obsession that I had at the time. So I gave Ray that dream, because what happened to that project was that it was lost. It was too ambitious, and it was lost. So I gave him that. I gave him my dream. So in a sense, there is a part of that. My dream of the time, I'm not really interested in it now, Or if I am interested in it now, I would be interested in doing it in a slightly different way.
How many songs are taken from Lifehouse as opposed to the newer songs?
About 4 or 5.
About 4 or 5.
Do you work better with a set concept to work with instead of a batch of songs in an album?
What are you saying? That this is what I always do, or
it's the fourth time, isn't it?
It must run to 10 or 12 times. I mean, I think my first concept album with The Who was The Who's third album, which was The Who's Third Album. But even A Quick One While He's Away, which was The Who's second album, was a concept album of sorts. And we've always tended to, as a band, always tended to be attracted to ideas that kind of concentrated us and focused us. Because The Who were an ideas band, an image band, not necessarily a music band. And as a writer, I was always serving a project rather than a group.
Is the female broadcaster in the record, is it based on the same one that you did a song about on Face Dancers?
No, not exactly. There's a bit of Julie in there, I think, definitely.
And when you say the club, I remember you meeting her in there one night.
No, you don't remember me meeting her there one night, because you actually asked me if I wanted to go to meet her, and I said no. Is that right?
Well, it boils down to the same thing, really. It's a bit of a shock that the two of you were in the same close environment.
Well. I would have no digital money to buy, certainly not now.
But has that kind of a person had a bit of a shock effect on you in the past?
No, the thing that Julie did that actually really did hurt me a bit was that when she started to review books for New Society, a couple of the books that I produced for Faber were produced, and she reviewed me as the editor rather than the book as the book, which seemed to me to be a bit of a waste of space. But no, in all other respects, you know, she's entitled to her opinion.
Hey, like Ray, do you still read your fan mail and what do you think about it?
I read it, yeah, I do read it. I do read it, and I don't, but I don't get very much. You get lots if you reply.
Pete, you said that you were going to be doing some kind of tour. What format will that tour take and where will you be going?
Well, originally my idea was to do a tour like today. Thank God I didn't decide to do that.
It was good.
I've got a band. The centre part of the thing, the psychedelic part, will be very much like what you've seen, only with a band playing music. And in where you heard tapes, there will be projections, as I explained before, fractals and computer art and stuff like that. And but I'm also doing old songs. I'm chopping and tailing it with two chunks of live performance. I'm doing my first opera, which is called the Mini Opera. 4 or 5 songs from the album I did with Ronnie Lang called Rough Mix. I just tried those live the other day and they're fucking great. And then at the end, I'm doing fairly bog standard solo rock stuff. Rough Boys, Face to Face, that kind of thing. Hey, say that again? Is this a question about your mum?
Yeah, that you're reforming The Who with your mum as front man or woman.
So. Yeah, when people used to say to me, our question was for anybody that didn't hear that, is that there's a rumour that we're reforming The Who with my mother as the front man. When people used to say to me how I managed to get along with the eccentrics in my life, like Keith Moon and Kit Lambert, I just used to say, go meet my mother, and you will understand how I manage. And I think, you know, she was really valuable to me in a way of hardening me up for the crazy world I live in. But I don't think she could replace Keith Moon, however young she thinks she is.
Hey, did you ever consider this as a Who project?
Did you
ever consider this as a Who project?
No, I haven't really considered any Who projects for a long time. I've had a lot of conversations with Roger about what he and I might do together. I'm not really interested in the Who very much. I'm interested in its history and I'm glad of it, you know, but I don't see a future for it. I think I was actually quite, I don't mean to I've been doing this a bit in interviews lately, kind of looking like, you know, the way that the 89 celebration tour was not my idea, but it wasn't really my idea. It's just, it grew and grew and became something very big, and And I thought it was remarkable that when we actually got back together, the three of us, very, very controlled, mature, grown up, with the Who finished, that when we got back to celebrate what we'd done in the past, we went right back to being on the big rock and roll stadium wheel, which is what really destroyed us in the first place. And I thought that that was remarkable, that we should allow that to happen. I don't think we played one small theatre on the whole tour. We played Radio City and Universal Studios, the theatre at Universal Studios, but they're both massive, they're 5,000. So there was no intimacy, there was no real rock and roll, there was none of the... And the band was a big band, which because I actually dictated that. And it felt like a great big wheel. So I'm worried about the fact that, you know, however much Roger and I sit around and talk about, you know, it would be good to get back and do some good old rock and roll, that as soon as we got back together again, it would just be this big wheel rolling. It's very difficult to control.
Pete, you've been away quite some time, not making records and things. Have you become disenchanted?
Have I become who?
Disenchanted.
No.
Why have you not made records recently?
There are two reasons. When after I finished my last record, I've forgotten what it was now.
So I'm Man.
My wife and I decided to have another child, and it's quite late for both of us. It felt later for me than it was for her, I think. And I decided that what I would do differently this time would be to spend at least 18 months or 2 years, you know, watching the wheels go around, as John Lennon said, you know, a house husband, as home as much as possible. And so I didn't even record or write for a year. Then, after my son was about a year old, I started to write songs. When he was about 18 months, I went back into the studio. And when he was about two, I had my album ready to deliver. And I had a cycling accident, which you may have read about in your car, and and it really was devastating. I mean, it really was a devastating accident, because it took 18 months to get it back working again, and for 6 months I couldn't even type.
Do you still have problems with the hand? Because you was on David.
No, I can't do what.
You was on David Letterman.
All kinds of sexual things. Thank you. No, other people too. It won't twist, you see. So, unless the person that you're is in the right position. So it was really big. It was a big problem, and that actually kept me off again for another 18 months. So cumulatively, it turned out to be 3.5 years. But you know, as you get older. You know, I'm going to be 50 in 2 years. Time just fucking flashes by. You know, what might seem to a long time to a young chap like you is, it just flashes by for me, it really does. It just seems like 10 minutes.
How is the hand now?
It's getting better, you know. I mean, I wouldn't have taken this on today if I'd have been able to play, but I was disappointed in myself today. I actually couldn't catch fire. So when I do the show, I've got two guitar players with me. I've got Phil Palmer and Andy Fairweather. So I'm hoping, and what we've done in rehearsal actually seems to work. In other words, I don't have to play all the time. I'm just sort of bursting into life, and I get so arthritic playing that.
What about, as the doctor said, no more windmills?
He said that the wrist is stronger now than it ever was before. So.
Right, time has flashed by, I'm afraid, so we've got time for one more question, then we're going to finish.
There's a couple of instrumentals on the prepared from here at Barber. And anybody that's aware of the Soldier Boy will know that. I think you either dedicated an album to Mayor Barber, really only the Soldier Boy. There's probably there's anything connection.
No, you know there wasn't. I have done a series of albums dedicated to Mayor Barber, one which was re-released last year to very good reviews, thank you very much for those, called Who Came First, that was released on Ryko. That was a bunch of devotional songs which I'd done, which were collected back together again and stuck out. Now what was different about this was that one of the things that I tried to do was to attempt a workshop at the Young Vic Theatre with a selected crowd of about 200 people And I would take, and my intention was to take data about their physiology, their biology, their astrology, and anything I could, feed it into a computer according to a set of compositional principles that I'd written on paper, produce a piece of music for each of them, a lyric for each of them, in other words, turn each of them into a song. And then at the end of the concert, which was going to be about 6 weeks long, not constantly, but every day we would come back and work and film and record, I was going to take, say, 20 of those and play them all at once. And my theory was that if these people were in harmony, if they were happy, if they were settled, if they were comfortable with the project, then the pieces of music would fit together. And as an experiment, the first subject I chose was my spiritual master of the day, who I still follow today, Maya Barber. And I used him as my subject. And one of the pieces was Barbara O'Reilly, and three of the other items, which I called M1, M2, M3, M4, M5, are on Psychedelic, dressed up a bit. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks a lot for coming. I really appreciate it.